Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Jersey Coastal Live. I'm Andrea Tarr, and every week I have the very good fortune to speak to a guest who is from the Jersey Shore or beyond about a subject such as food, pop culture, entertainment, anything of interest, anything that I think would be interesting to my listeners. And today we're speaking to a filmmaker, Frank M. Callow. He's a New York-based filmmaker. He's actually an independent producer and director. He's got more than 20 years of industry experience. For example, his critically acclaimed movie, The Believer, we're going to talk a little bit more of that, starring Ryan Gosling and Billy Zane, won the Grand Jury Prize at the 2001 Sundance Festival. And Frank has worked on studio pictures for Lionsgate and New Line Cinemas with such people as Robert De Niro, Demi Moore, Mike Myers, Shelley Winters, and Marlon Brando. He is a graduate of the NYU Tisch School of Film, and he's also taught for the Columbia Graduate Film Program, the Harvard Film Program, and the International Film and Television Workshop in Rockport, Maine. His latest project is a very unusual documentary, and we're going to talk a little bit more of that as a little bit later in the show. But first of all, Frank, welcome, and thanks for being my guest.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Andrea. Thank you for having us, and I really appreciate this you having your time and putting us on the show here. We all really appreciate it here at FMC Productions.
Well, you know, it's really my pleasure because, you know, we've known each other for a while and I've wanted to talk to you. And so this just presented the perfect opportunity. So
I want to talk a little bit
about your background because today I was watching on, YouTube. So, of course, it had to be true. There was an interview. You were on a show called The Way to Go.
Oh, yes. Yes. We did that. Yes.
Yeah, and so I learned a few things about you. I suspected you, not bad, but I suspected you were from the Midwest, so I see you're from Chicago.
Yes, yeah.
Guilty. And so is that where you got your start in filmmaking?
It's not in filmmaking. I started off in the theater. When I was a young boy, I always wanted, I knew what I was wanted to do. I wanted to be a director and a producer. I never wanted to be an actor. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I have five sisters, and I used to line them up. They're all different ages. And I used to line them up and say, okay, here's a play that we're going to do. And now we get mad at them because they wouldn't recite the lines, and they would throw the script at me or the book at me. But I was like 4 years old, 5 years old. And because of a sixth grade teacher that helped me, because no one really was there in that world to help me, and she helped recognize something, and then she said, you know, you should follow this path. So I've learned how to follow the path, which got me to the Goodman Theater in Chicago, which at the time was a private school for directors, and it was an undergrad school program. And so I ended up getting accepted there with a full scholarship. And so I learned the theater world. I really was involved in the theater world. And when I came to New York City, I was heavily involved in the theater world. I mean, I hooked myself up with one of a theater company called the Forum of Italian American Playwrights. And from that theater, we produced Nine, the original production of Nine on Broadway with Raul Julia, which ran for like 10 years on Broadway. And they kind of took me under their wing, and because I used to do everything for them. And then for the money I made from that, I used for film school. I went to film school with that and the Tisch program, and then I never really looked back. So I just stayed in the film world after that.
But I'm curious, how could you know at such a young age that you want? I mean, I'm thinking, at such a young age, how did you even know what a director and a producer was? Or were you naturally bossy with your sisters?
I just knew. I used to go to the library, and people, get books at the library. I would get plays, and I would read them. I read Death of a Salesman, I think, when I was like 7 years old, but I didn't understand it, of course. I didn't know that. Then when I got reintroduced to it, I knew it. I knew the subtext of it, and I studied with I was one of the fortunate people here in New York City to be the only few directors who studied with Elie Kazan. And things that he taught me back in those days, I still ring true today. I mean, he taught me what a director really does, what's a real, how to fine-tune my craft. And as a director, what we do is people think you direct the actors, the you know, there's many factors that we do, but what we really do is we direct the subtext. It's all about the subtext of the material. And that's how you communicate with your actors. That's how you communicate with your production designer. And that's what we direct. We don't give line readings. We don't stand and say, here, say mm-hmm. like that. That's our move over there. That's not directing. Unless it's a specific spot
right.
for the camera, then you have to do that, yes. But I learned a lot from him coming from that world. But ever since I was a young boy, I always knew this is what I wanted to do. I just knew it. And I just had to find that path. And thank God I was able to do that, you know.
Well, seriously, you're very fortunate that you were able to follow your dream, and here you are, a director and a producer. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And like every other director, I mean, like everybody else, I started from the bottom up. It wasn't, I just was not anything. I worked 17, 18, 20 hours a day, night and day, cleaning the theater, doing this, doing that, and then having to have a day job, too, and until I was able to finance my, you know, to support myself now, you know, and but I work, you know, but I didn't care. It wasn't like work to me. It was just, that's what I wanted to do. That's where I wanted to be. And so it was like you just said about your radio show, that you just, it feels like it's the first time you do, every time you do it, it's like the first time. That's the exact same feeling. You know, it's, you know, you get that feeling, so.
Well, the labor of love, it's really not work when you love what you're doing.
Yeah, and you have to, in our business, you have to love the business. You have to love it. Otherwise, it's going to eat you alive. It's a tough business. It's a hard business. People think it's romantic, but there's a lot of work involved. I mean, people come up to me nowadays and say, oh, I saw your last film. And I say, oh, yeah, I did that 2 years ago because I'm already working on my next film. 2 years to make a movie, you know. So it's like, but it's a lot of hard work and a lot of disappointments, a lot of rejection, a lot of crap. You know, a lot of people fill your head with crap. And you got to be, the most important thing, you have to stay in reality. You have to stay within that reality of what's really there. And you're not above the law. You're just a hard worker just like anybody else.
Yeah.
But you have to love the business. You know, and if you don't have the love for it, it's going to eat you alive. You might as well just find something that you love and do it.
Now, Frank, what do you love most about being a director? What just does it for you?
The storytelling. I'm a storyteller. You know, I've always been a storyteller. And I think that's the most important thing. That's what I always look at. I mean, when someone sends a script to me, it's all about the story. If I like the story, and this, just because I reject the story does not mean that another director is going to respond to it. Yes, that's because they know how to respond to their own stuff that they like. I respond to the stuff I like, and I'm fortunate now where I'm at a position in my life where I can do what I want to do. I mean, I used to work for Studio Pictures, and sometimes I was assigned a picture. I had pictures I didn't want to do. I mean, mm-hmm. I came up in the old, you know, horror films. I did horror films, some of the serious horror films you ever saw in your life. You know, but it was good.
I saw that on the interview
good.
That you worked on horror films. Yeah,
I was, you know, and if you look at those films, you go, oh my God, we'll never show this to my own kid. You know, but now I'm fortunate to be able to do and pick and choose. And I'm very picky because time is a factor. I mean, you know, it takes a year and a half to make a movie. That's just to make it if you got the financing. Then all the years of trying to get the financing for it. And then, you know, before you know it, time has passed and you got four films done and you know, you're looking for your next three. So I'm very picky. I know that. But to answer your question, it's all in storytelling. If I respond to it, and I can, and I'm a writer as well, so I know the structure of the cinema world. So,
well, I have to ask you about the movie The Believer, because I saw that years ago, well before I ever met you.
Oh yeah,
And it's hard for me to really even just, you know, I'm Jewish, and a friend of mine said to me, "You have to see this movie. You just won't believe it." And it was highly disturbing, but I guess, you know, the story was amazing. It was upsetting. It was just everything. It was so emotional. And I can't even imagine anyone doing a better job than Ryan Gosling did in that part.
Yeah, but believe it or not, he was a nobody then. No one knew him then. That was his big break. And after that, he never looked back. And it was
that
credit
was his
to
big break. Really?
Yeah, that
okay.
was his. Yes. Matter of fact, Henry Bean is the writer and director on that, and he was fabulous. Henry was fabulous, and we knew we wanted Ryan, but the studios didn't want him at first. They wanted some other kid because Ryan was an unknown at the time, and we stuck to our guns, and Ryan was perfect for that, and he, you know, because he was coming off a young Hercules then. He was playing young Hercules and that kids' TV show, and he had long blonde hair and stuff, and then we told him there was he had a kid shaved, and he said no problem. But that movie, I still get calls from, believe it or not, I used to get a lot of calls from the synagogues to come in and talk about that film. And because to me, that film, it's a dark film, yes, but it's a special film because it really deals with faith, you know, trusting your faith and whatever it may be. And I think the whole world is going through that right now. But it's like, it's trusting your faith. And Ryan was fabulous. I mean, I just knew it. You know, when we saw him, I saw him doing that. I said, oh, my God, this kid's incredible.
Well, I think for anyone listening, that movie was done in 2001. Well, that's when it was in the Sundance Festival. So it's about that time frame.
Yeah.
But if you haven't seen it, I'm sure either on Netflix or somewhere you can find it, because it's absolutely worth watching. It's really breathtaking. It's very upsetting.
Yeah, and you're right.
Dark.
It was disturbing. Yeah. And my job, when I came in as production executive, my job was to put everything together, make sure. And I'll tell you something else if you want to talk a little story about that behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Teresa Russell played the lady, the leader of the Aryan Nation group. But at first, we didn't have Teresa Russell. We had another star who I won't mention, but we had another star involved for a whole month. And we had everything set up. Everything was ready to go to shoot that following Monday. For like 6 weeks, we were in rehearsals, setting everything up, locations, all that kind of stuff, camera crew. And then I told my crew, I said, listen, go get your last drink because we're going to be shooting. It's going to be crazy for a while, so it's going to be a lot of hours. So this is the last weekend you're going to have. So I'm having a drink with my assistant, and I get a call from the studio saying that this certain star decided to drop out because she realized she didn't want to play that type of a role. And I said, I said, are you crazy? And she had it for 6 weeks. We were in a rehearsal, and now she decides she doesn't want to play the leader of the Aryan Nation. And so we got pushed back a week. And so the studio said, don't worry, we'll get you somebody else. And they did. Within a week, they got Teresa Russell, who came in, knew every single line, knew everything, and just came in and did it. But for us, from a production point of view, it knocked our whole schedule off because we locked in schedules. We had new locations. We had to find new locations for every day. And it was crazy for production. So what I ended up doing was putting on two location teams so that one would be there shooting and one be out looking for the next location for the next day, you know. So it was crazy for us. And then one time we were celebrating in like 5 years later in out in Sundance, and Ryan was there. So we were talking about it. And I said, yeah, remember when that star dropped out? He goes, no, I had no clue. And that was a compliment because I told Henry, I said, just keep shooting.
Right.
We'll take care of this. And the actors and the creative team never really knew what really happened. So that was good on the production part because we kept it away from them, you know. So, but Ryan was wonderful in that.
I guess that's always one of the challenges of being a filmmaker, is that everything does not go according to plan, and you have to be prepared.
You have to have a plan A, B, and C. Yeah, you always got to have a plan A, B, and C on your day of shooting. The basic philosophy is you have a rain day. What if you're outside shooting and it rains? You have to have a place to go inside to shoot. You know, because once you're shooting, your money, it's costing you money. You know,
mm-hmm.
and you got to pay the crew regardless. So,
exactly.
So yeah, you got to have a plan. But you have a plan A, B, and C ready to go.
So what are some films that you found especially inspirational, or that you felt told a really good story?
I love films like American Beauty. I think that was a fabulous film to me. I think Jurassic was a very a good friend of mine, Bobby Moresco, did Crash. He did Crash,
yeah.
And I just saw the new one, the new film with Benicio del Toro in it and Emily Blunt. It came out. It's called El. I forgot the name of it. It was in English. It means the hitman. He plays a Mexican hitman, and it's a fabulous film. It's I love films like Traffic, Crash, American Beauty. Things are character driven, storytelling. That, and I don't look for messages. There's no message. I'm not a crusader, so I don't look for messages. You know, I just look for the story and what's happening within that story. And I thought American. Boogie Nights. Boogie Nights, another film I thought was great. So, and they all came out, and they all came out around the same time.
Are you drawn to things that are a little bit on the dark side?
No, it depends on the story. It depends on the script. I have a comedy we're working on, you know. But I like, it really depends on the script. I do tend to go to drama because we have a couple of films that we're doing now called Johnny Posto and Eyes of the Kings. And Eyes of the Kings deal with the Latin Kings. But it's about the women. I write strong women characters. And Penelope Cruz is going to be playing that part. We talked about Michelle Rodriguez to play another part. But it's a great story and it's not about the Latin Kings per se, the gang. It's not a gang movie. It's about a lady, a cop, who's trying to get a boy out of the gang. And she talks the DA's office into letting him do community service in a retirement home. And in that retirement home is when he realizes how precious life is, because he sees people at the end of their lives. And it's a wonderful story. It's a beautiful story. And so I like heartfelt, warm films, drama, not sappy, but you know, drama, you know, that kind of stuff.
All right. So let's talk about your latest project, or I shouldn't say your latest, but one of your new projects is Hernan, Panama, which is a little bit different for you because this is a documentary and you are typically a filmmaker.
Right. It's my first documentary.
First documentary. All right. Well, let's, right from the beginning, how did this project even come to you?
Well, a good friend of mine and producer and partner in my company, FMC Production, is Doug Proctor. And he lives out there as well. He lives in the Long Branch area, and a lot of people know him from the promotion world. And we hooked up about 10 years ago, became friends, and then started working together. Well, he knew a friend that came to him in Panama. His name's Mickey Keats. I believe he's from Jersey as well. And so Dougie brought to him, I said, Frank, you got to really, really look at this project. This is about this man that is incredible. And he fell in love with it. And I said at first, I said, well, you know, it's a documentary. I really don't do documentaries. And then we kept pushing and pushing. And then finally him and I decided to go down and visit Hernan in Panama. In Panama, and this is a story. It's a fascinating story. And I sat there watching this man. We jumped off the back of a truck to shoot footage with him, and what it is, this man who was 2 years old, just learning how to walk in the jungles of Venezuela, and quack doctors, he had a fever, and they took too much spinal fluid from his body. And he ended up paralyzed. He's walking on all fours, like a dog. He ends up his life walking on all fours. And then at 6 years old, his family's poor. They had a lot of brothers and sisters. So his mother and father just kind of like left him on the roadside. You know, there's nothing they could do. They just left him and moved on. And he hooked up with a group of beggars, and they said, listen, you better start learning how to beg for them because you're not going to do anything else. And then he got involved with missionaries, he got involved with foster homes, got abused, and somehow 40, 30 years later, because he's 59 years old now, he made his way to Panama City where he's been working, begging on this one block that's a very busy street in Panama. And for over 20, 30 years, that's how he makes his living. He walks, you know, he's on his all fours, and people stop by the cars, give him a dollar here, a dollar there, And that you say, okay, and so everybody does, you know, so what's so unusual about that? But what I was fascinated by the whole thing as watching him was his positive energy. He dressed good. He looked good. He has a wife. He has three kids. And he said to us, and, you know, if you watch the trailer, which is on, you could watch it on the Kickstarter campaign because we started a Kickstarter campaign for it. And that's the best way to watch it because you'll see the donation list and you also see what we're doing with it. And you also see the trailer. But what happens is his positive attitude. He's strong. He has strong faith. He just has a very talk about faith. He has very strong faith. He says, please don't pity me. Don't pity me. I don't want your pity. If anything, I'm here to help others. I'm here to be with others. And I just thought that was fascinating because most of the people I was with said, oh, we could do this with him. We could make him look like that. I said, no. He's not asking for that. He's saying, don't pity me. And his positive attitude and what this man's been through It was amazing. I was inspired by it, and then I saw people jump out of their cars who he knew, asking him for advice mm-hmm. on social issues. On what should he do? Like, my wife is doing this, or my kid's doing this, and he gives advice. And this man cannot read or write, of course, but he's very well versed. He's has a good vocabulary. And you know, when we get him together, you know, we put him in a wheelchair and we sit at the restaurant, we talk, and you would never know it. But then when he gets off that wheelchair, he has to walk on all fours. And he's a very positive man. In today's world, to me, I think that's what's important. I think it's important, very, very important.
Mm-hmm. I guess in his opinion, he has a good life.
Yes, you're exactly right. He does. And he says, I said, well, how do you do? I mean, he pays taxes. He pays his taxes. He does in his world out there. And I'll tell you something else. Everybody in Panama knows him. We were at a restaurant, and the owner of the restaurant came up to us because they knew what we were doing. They go, "Oh, we know Hernan. Everybody knows him by the name of Hernan."
Yeah.
They call him Hernan. In Spanish, it's Hernan de Panama, and so everybody knows him. And we have a lot of political support. There's a big Panamanian film festival that's in April, and they want to premiere the documentary there because the Panamanian Film Festival is becoming one of the biggest film markets where studios, everybody goes to market their Latin market, their films on the Latin market. Kind of what the mm-hmm. Berlin Film Festival does for the international market. So a lot of people go there, and we have a lot of support from the film commissioner, from the town, from the politicians, and they said, whatever you need, we'll close down the street, we'll make it happen for you. They all know him, and he's on a very busy street. He works 9 to 5. Monday through Sunday. Sunday he takes a day of rest. So
Frank, how does he feel about sharing his story with the world?
He's excited. He's very excited. He loves it. He has a charisma about him too. There's a form of formidability about him too that I like. He has a presence. He definitely has a presence when you get to meet him, when you get to talk to him, and he listens very carefully. You see him listening to everything we say. And I speak Spanish, so that helps a lot to communicate. And then we also have a translator there for when I'm very busy, so that I can make sure I hear exactly what he's asking. And what you see in that trailer when he talks about how he wants to help others and how what God means to him and his mm-hmm. life means to him, that's all his words. Those are his words. We did not give him something to script. It's not a scripted piece. It's like those were his words that we chose to use that he said to us. And that's how we put that whole trailer together. It's only a 3-minute trailer. It's a very short, fast,
right. It's
very well together trailer.
And just to remind anyone who's listening, I know you can just go right to Kickstarter.com, and you can type in Hernan of Panama. But I will also put links on my blog, which I'll put up after the show, so you can click directly on it and see the trailer for yourself.
Yeah, thank you. That's amazing. Yeah.
How does he get back and forth to work?
He drives.
Is he driven?
He drives.
He drives.
Yeah, he has people that help him get in his car.
Wow.
He steps in, and his car is custom made to fit his seat. And once he's sitting up, like he'll sit in a wheelchair. In the trailer, you'll see him in the wheelchair. Yeah, I thought that was a fascinating image, and I said I need to get a shot of him getting off that a wheelchair and walking the way he does. And because you would look and you say, okay, he's in a wheelchair, okay. But then when he gets off that chair and starts walking on his fours, that's the image right there. But he drives. His wife helps him. He gets in the car from 9 to 5. He's working, and he comes home. He has dinner. I had arguments just with my wife, just like everybody else does, you know. and then we kiss and we make up, just like anybody else, you know. So, and his wife is a very attractive lady. You'll see a picture of him in the trailer. She's Panamanian Indian, and she's very, very an interesting lady herself, you know. And they were together. They've been together for a long time now.
So, obviously, there's a language barrier. You speak a little bit of Spanish. But what are some of the other challenges about filming outside of the U.S. in a foreign country?
You have to prepare yourself. First of all, we have production insurance. And second of all, you have to prepare yourself, and you have to recognize and respect the country that you're shooting in, no matter where it's at, or the state, or the, like sometimes I shoot all over the place. I shot in Virginia, I shot in London, I shoot all over. But you have to learn how to respect that, and you have to learn how to get allow them in. You don't want to walk in there with your whole crew. You want to hire from there. Our idea is to hire some people from there. And we're giving back to the economy by providing hotels, travel, restaurants, payments, wages, and so you got to learn how to lay the land. I'm a strong believer in the pre-production stage. The production stage, which is the shooting, that's the fun part for me. The editing is just me and the editor. That's the best stage. But pre-production is the hardest, and I'm a strong advocate of organization and being organized. And I come from old school, and I was taught by some of the old guys. And back then, you didn't. You knew, you just shut up and you watched and you listened and you worked your ass off and you just did everything you had to do. And I learned how to organize. And to me, that's very important, because what you're really doing doesn't mean that nothing's going to happen. But what you do is you build yourself a foundation so that when something does happen, you're able to fix it. And the first thing you want to do is go talk to the film commissioners in that state, in that city, in that country, wherever, because they're very supportive and they'll be able to help you get through a lot of the things you don't know. Because you got to remember, you're in a strange land. And I do speak English fluently, so it's like, that helps a lot.
Oh, you do? Okay, okay.
Yeah.
So you are hoping to get back to Panama in January, which is January of 2016, and finish up your filming?
Yes, okay. Yes. We want to get back there in January, and we're going to be shooting there for like 30 days. Our intention is to make a 30 to 60-minute documentary. And in today's market, the documentary world has opened a lot. One of the reasons why I really never touched it is because there was never a market back when I was starting out in this business. I mean, there really wasn't. And it always seemed like it took forever. You hear people making those films, documentary films, for like 3, 4, 5 years. I'm the type of person, I want to get in there, make it, and get out. You know, I like to I like these that are finished. I like to start them, and I like to finish them. And but today's world, with TV, HBO, Showtime, Cinemax, Cable, Learning Channel, they show some of the best documentary now.
That's
documentaries
right. That's
nowadays.
Right.
I mean, some really good stuff out there.
There is. So I think it's exciting that you're doing a documentary. It's really pretty inspirational that he is living in his own way such a normal kind of life. So I'm really looking forward to seeing the movie.
And
it's funny
that you said that, because that's exactly what he said. He said, I'm just as normal as anybody else. And he has a normal schedule, he has a normal life, he has a normal but he had to learn, like all of us, he had to learn how to make his living. And that's how he did it. And it's amazing. Well, you hit it right in the head with that.
Well, his normal is different than most of our normals, but for him, it's just the way he lives every day.
Yeah.
I think I have a lot of admiration for that. I really do. Now, we have about 3 minutes left to go, and I know you have another project that you are working on with HBO TV. Thought you might want to say something about that.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. That's a new project we have. My co-writer, who also is from Jersey, from Point Pleasant, New Jersey, his name is Rick Martinson, and he's been my co-writer for like the last 10 years. I don't go anywhere without him as a writer. And the thing is, we wrote a new TV series called ESQ, short for Esquire, and it's about five major characters who work at an exclusive gentleman's club here in New York City. But the thing is, a girl comes in and dances in a burqa. She's from Yemen, but she comes in and dances in a burqa, and it sets off this whole sacrilegious ripple throughout the world, through Mexico, Middle East, Bible Belt in the South, and it deals with the hypocrisy of the religion. And and we just finished the 10th episode. We just finished season one, which we're hoping to get into the production very, very soon with the backing of HBO. It's kind of like a Hell on Wheels versus Boardwalk Empire type show, 1 hour show, and we have some stars involved already. We have Dayton Cali from Sons of Anarchy and Deadwood. And, again, he's another Jersey guy. There you go. And we're talking to Rihanna wants to play one of the roles as a dancer. And so I have to make a decision if we're going to go that way. But it's a great show, too. That's going to be a wonderful show. And that's going to be – you're going to hopefully see that next year, September, at fall time. And they're trying to slot it for their fall program.
Fall of 2016. Okay. Okay, so we are down to our final minute, and I want to say, Frank Callow, I'm so happy to have had this opportunity to have you on Jersey Coastal Live, and I wish you great success with the Kickstarter campaign. I will put
Thank
up my
you so
blog
much.
after. My pleasure. The blog will go up within the hour, and there'll be links to everything. And again, I encourage people to go out and watch The Believer if you haven't already seen it. It's really pretty amazing.
Thank you. And I want to say thank you to all the people who are listening and all who do check in, because without the audience base, we would have nothing. So thank you, guys.
Okay, so can 30 minutes change your life? Maybe. So please, keep listening to Jersey Coastal Live. Till next time, I'm Andrea Tarr. Thank you so much, Frank, for being with me. And talk
to you
soon. Okay, bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
My pleasure. Bye, Frank.
Bye-bye.